Hi, this is Bernie Wise on the air with the Radio Heritage Network, or the Heritage Radio Network, and we're at in Bushwick, beautiful downtown Bushwick, at Roberta's Restaurant. And my guest today is Carol Butler, who's been a frequent guest, and we're going to talk about animal behavior, a little bit about bird migration, and other interesting topics. Our sponsor today is Fairway Markets, and we all know about Fairway. Okay, and to start off, I want to remind you that on the photo gallery, there are some pictures when I start to talk about, if we get to it today, I don't know if we'll get to the octopuses. If not, it'll be the next week's show, but we'll see what we get to. So I'm going to ask Carol to say hello to everybody and tell us about her books that she has, and then we'll get down to the topics.
Okay, greetings, everybody. Hopefully we'll get to talk about mimicry, if not today, on next week's show. And Bernie uploaded some incredible pictures of an octopus that we'll talk about, and I uploaded some which didn't go through properly, so I will upload them again. Today we're going to talk about birds a little bit. I had the pleasure of going birding with Bernie in New York's Central Park. Something, even though I've written two books about birds, it's something I had never done before, although I've been in Central Park many times, and Bernie is an expert in the park. You serve as a guide, and you really know all the ins and outs in the park.
Right, but I'm not a bird guide in the park.
Well, but you're
just a people guide, but I know the park very well. So the birders know where to go to look for the birds in the park.
Right. And when we went a couple of weeks ago, the first time, and it was the warbler migration, and there were a lot of bird watchers in the park. And we had a devil of a time trying to see any warblers. They're very small. They move very fast. And we saw a couple, but mm-hmm. It was really difficult even to identify them. Although you identified one, I think. We have one that we saw. I was at Green Chimneys yesterday. Let me mention that.
Tell us about Green Chimneys.
Green Chimneys is up in Brewster, New York. It's a school for children and of all ages, from very early through high school. And it's a wonderful facility that has a wildlife I don't know what you call it. They have all kinds of farm animals as well as all kinds of birds of prey, all kinds of interesting animals there. And the kids not only go to school but work with the animals and with the garden. And I was with Peter Campagnolo, who's my co-author on the book about birds of prey, How Fast Does a Falcon Dive, we were there to sort of promote the book, although the book isn't coming out till August. But I was telling Peter that we had been in the park, and he said warblers are really difficult. He goes on a collecting trip for the museum once a year to bring back specimens for various studies that they're using. And if a small bird like a warbler is really difficult to collect, not only is it difficult to see in your binoculars, much less to get a photograph of, but imagine if you have to shoot it and then find it.
Right.
Not only find an appropriate species for the collection, but then it falls in the high grass. He said you can spend hours just trying to collect one specimen.
Which museum does he collect for?
American Museum of Natural History,
our favorite museum.
Right.
Yeah, I was under the impression, though, that they use these mist nets also in open spaces. Mm-hmm. They do. I don't know about in the rainforest. Probably couldn't spread a mist net.
Right.
But in other places, they have these nets that they spread out. It looks like a badminton net. Or a volleyball net, but it's a very fine mesh,
right?
And the birds get stuck in it, and then it's easy. They take them out, put them in tubes, especially like the hummingbirds. Remember,
right?
They stick them in tubes to calm them down, and then they can work.
Well, I know they use mist nets with bats because we wrote about it in the bat book. But I think with hummingbirds it's a problem because they're so small. They can get stuck in the net. We used hall traps when we trapped them, which is, it's like a curtain that goes around the feeder and drops down.
I've seen mist nets used for warblers and other
migrating
birds.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
So I brought my list.
Oh, you brought your list, okay.
Because I think that even people who live in New York I grew up and born in New York and lived all my life there and had no idea of the variety of birds. And people who are birders and know about the variety would be interested too to know what we saw in two relatively brief visits, right? Mm-hmm. We have a couple of hours each time. So I'm going to tell you what birds so far I have marked down in my list. We saw a black-crowned night heron last time, Canada goose, of course, those you see everywhere, a mallard, also very popular, rock pigeon, lots of those in the city. We saw a red-bellied woodpecker, which is a little special. We saw a blue jay, both times, actually, we saw a blue jay. We saw lots of robins. I got a wonderful photograph of a robin. Lots of starlings. We saw a gray catbird, which was interesting. We saw a common yellowthroat. That was the warbler.
Right. They're common because there are a lot of them around. That's why they're called common yellowthroats.
Right.
And most of the birds that Carol mentioned are in Central Park all year round. They even stay in the wintertime.
Right.
So you can see them in the winter.
We saw a house sparrow. Mm-hmm. Which is also a very common bird. We saw a cardinal both times. Evidently, there was a resident population of cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
But they're beautiful and just incredible to see in the middle of the city. Just wonderful. And common grackle, which is also a beautiful bird, although an ordinary bird. But it's a blue iridescent over black. And I got some wonderful photographs. They didn't print beautifully, but they look beautiful because I was trying to get that blue.
Right.
And then what's the other thing? A Baltimore Oriole we saw the first time. That was just great.
That's a spectacular bird. Yeah. Right. Yes, they come through in the spring. And some of them may even nest in the park. But most of them go further north up to the Adirondacks and places like that where you have really deep woodlands and stuff.
Right.
But they're called Baltimore Orioles. So some of them, there's another name for them, Orchard Oriole, which may or may not be the same species. So they're a spectacular bird. And if you want to see pictures of those birds, just Google. You know, these days you just Google whatever you want and you get a picture of it. So that.
And there's one hummingbird that is sometimes seen in the park, which so far we didn't see, and that is, Is it an anna's? What kind is it?
Ruby-throated green, I think it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just looking in front of me. And I just was curious, just while we're talking about this, what other birds have you seen in your birding in the park that were special?
Well, the warblers are really special when they come through because they're smaller. They look like canaries.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are sort of yellowish, and they're really beautiful. And they're hard to see because the migration coincides with the blooming out of the trees. So if they're the same color as yellow-green leaves, they're very hard to see. So I think most folks have to get up very early to go see the warblers. And we didn't get up that early.
Right.
We just had a nice morning in the park. But you can probably see 30, 40 different kinds of warblers easily.
Really?
In the height of the migration. And there are other birds, too, that pass through. I saw a blue grosbeak a couple of weeks ago, which I had never seen before. It's a pale blue color, and it's called a grosbeak because it has a very thick beak for cracking seeds. And there's another one, the rose-breasted grosbeak. I know some of these names sound strange, but that's the way my birds are.
Right.
They've been named a long time ago, and some of the names just stuck.
And these are migratory? These you just can see at a certain time of the year?
Right, they come up in the spring, and you can see them all summer where they stop over, but Central Park is really a stopping point because you just imagine if you're a bird flying, most of them are migrating up the Atlantic seaboard from Mexico and Central and South America, and you're flying over New York City and you see this green area spot. It's like an oasis.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the birds, it's very long migration, so they stop at Central Park to refuel and rest, and then they move all over New England.
Right.
Another flyway near us is up the Hudson Valley.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of raptors go, like you were up in Brewster, which isn't too far from the Hudson Valley.
Right.
And raptors are birds of prey, like hawks and eagles and falcons and kestrels, which are the little tiny hawks.
Right.
So they go up the flyway right up the Hudson Valley, and then there's another flyway out over Long Island.
Right.
So in the fall, Carol, we'll have to go out to Fire Island.
Fire Island, right.
And see the reverse migration of the monarch butterflies and the raptors. It's a great spot.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about migration, we didn't really plan to talk about migration today, but there's a lot of interest about it. If you think about migration, the birds really prefer to fly over land. And so they're really challenged when they come to some place like the Gulf of Mexico or crossing the Sahara Desert. I mean, that's land, but there's no food there for them. And so there are places where bird watchers go where the migrating birds converge because they're trying to stay over land. So Fire Island, New York City is like that, right?
Right.
Eilat in Israel is the southernmost point before they go across the Sahara.
Right.
And that also, if you go to Eilat, I went to a migration conference and a lot of people had been to Eilat.
Right.
Millions of birds. And then there's a place in Mexico, which I don't remember the name, unfortunately, but if you look at the map, there's a place where there's a very narrow part of the land mass, and they go. There's an observation center there as well, because they also get thousands, if not millions, of birds migrating through that one spot.
Right.
So, and the Kittatinny Mountains in Pennsylvania.
Right. Hawk Mountain.
I'm going there in the fall with Peter.
Good.
I made him promise to take me there.
Peter's your co-author for the book on raptors?
Yeah, because a lot of raptors migrate through there. And if you read anything about raptors, you always read about the Kittatinny Mountains and how fabulous that migration is.
Good. Okay, so this is the end of our first segment. And in the second segment, we're going to talk about how insects breathe and sizes of insects. And then we'll get into another topic after that. So we'll be right back. Hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the air with my special guest today, Carol Butler, who's an author of five books, and occasionally we'll talk about her books. Okay, on this second segment, we're going to talk about insects. Now, the show today is sort of a magazine, which means a collection of different things. That's the word magazine is a storehouse.
Very nice.
So magazines are come to mean storehouses of information. So we're going to talk about the sizes of insects and why there aren't any really giant insects in the world. Most insects are pretty small. There are some, you know, maybe some that are 10 inches long or 12 inches long, but I don't think there are any really bigger than that, except for like the horseshoe crab, which is related to spiders. And that could be maybe a foot and a half long, but they're mostly small. And the reason, Carol, is...
Well, the reason is the relation. It has been suspected that the relationship between the amount of oxygen they take in and their body size, the reason is the amount of the limitation in their oxygen processing system. And recently there was an interesting study where they where they experimented with a bunch of different insects, and they found that Most insects develop a smaller body size when they're in an environment where the oxygen is limited, where there's less oxygen than normal. And some species develop a larger body size when they're in a highly saturated environment.
Yeah. So can you talk about how the insect's respiration is different than ours?
Certainly.
They don't have lungs, so how do they operate?
Right. Well, their respiratory system does the same thing ours does. It delivers oxygen to the cells and removes carbon dioxide. That's the waste product of cellular respiration, right? But their respiratory system is separate from the circulatory system and is a network of tubes, basically. And air comes into the body through openings on the exoskeleton. And you can see them. We see them all the time when we work with the butterflies. They're just little openings along the side of the thorax or the abdomen. And the airflow is regulated in some animals by small muscles that operate flaps within the spiracle so that they open or close it. Although in very small animals, the intake is very passive. In other words, whatever air happens to be drawn into the spiracles, that's enough to sustain the animal. But okay. You can see that it's limited than breathing.
So if the animal is just resting and not active, it doesn't need as much oxygen.
That's right.
So it just passively comes in to the spiracles, which get smaller and smaller as it goes through the body?
Spiracles don't get smaller. The tubes get smaller.
The tracheal tubes
get smaller, right.
Right.
And we know, or at least I learned in writing about bees, that when bees fly long distances when they're foraging, they obviously need more oxygen. And so in animals like bees, the pumping of the muscles that pump the wings also activates the spiracles and they get more oxygen into their system. So there are various ways, depending on the needs of the animal, to get air into the system. Then the tubes that carry the air get smaller and smaller, as Bernie said. And at the end of each tube, which is interesting, I didn't know this till I read this study, there's a thin, moist interface at the end of the tube, which is how the gas is exchanged between the air and the cell. Mm. Interesting.
Is it like a membrane?
Or? Yes. It's a moist membrane, but very, very tiny, of course. But okay. So that the air, the oxygen dissolves into the membrane through the liquid and the carbon dioxide dissolves out. And then what's also interesting is so that these tubes don't collapse while the animal is developing, they have a thin reinforcing sort of a wire of cuticle inside the larger membranes, which is like a hose that you use.
Reinforce in a hose.
Yeah. Right. You can picture that, a hose with that strengthens it so that it doesn't collapse.
Or like a vacuum cleaner hose.
Exactly. Right. I was trying to think of an appropriate hose. Right. And then there are certain parts of the tracheal system that allows the tissue to collapse that doesn't have these strengthening cuticle, this sort of wire-like structure. And those, so that there are air sacs that are created, which are little balloon-like structures that store a reserve of air, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, and I think butterflies don't have that. I've never heard of that in a butterfly because they're pretty simple. But in animals that live in very dry areas, for example, they will use some of these insects will use air sacs to conserve water. They'll close the spiracles and keep from evaporating the water in the system. Aquatic insects consume the air that's in the air bubbles while they're underwater, and they use it also to regulate their buoyancy.
Yeah, so these insects can't breathe underwater. They carry the oxygen with them.
They do in a lot of very interesting ways.
And periodically, they have to come up and get a new oxygen supply.
That's right. A lot of interesting variations on the way aquatic insects provide themselves with oxygen. Sometimes just the diffusion of gases through the body wall is sufficient to meet the metabolic needs of small aquatic insects, especially those when they live in cold, fast-moving streams where there's plenty of dissolved oxygen in the water. they really don't even need this process. They just take it in through their, they call it cuticular respiration. They take it right in through the skin.
It's almost like fish do with their gills, but except fishes have a circulation of blood, which That's carries right. their oxygen right. blood. But insects are different.
That's a good point, because there are some insects that have gills, but the gills are not part of the circulatory. The gills are different. The gills can be on the sides or the rear of the abdomen, and they just fan, which keeps them in contact with the water and allows them to take in oxygen. Oh, you're going to like this one. Dragonflies have internal gills that are associated with the rectum. So the water is circulated in and out of the anus by muscular contractions of the abdomen, if you can imagine that. So they're breathing through their rear, mm-hmm. right? And the rectal gill mechanism also serves as a jet propulsion system. So they can have a powerful contraction of the abdomen, which expels a jet of water and thrusts them forward to escape from predators.
Mm, we can make all kinds of remarks
about
that.
So they have very, 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 what is the word?
Efficient?
Not efficient, very... variable anal function.
Multiple functions.
Yes, versatile. So, that's the word I'm looking for.
Maybe if we, when we pass gas, you think it's
similar, right?
We could be jet propelled.
Except
you think?
It's not part of our breathing
across
system.
Across the room.
But yes. Okay. Then there are other aquatic insects that breathe through a siphon, which is like a diver's snorkel, right? Some mosquito larvae do that.
Right.
They have an extension. They're actually spiracles that are an extension from the back of the body. And the siphon, it's interesting, has a ring of closely spaced hairs which have a waterproof coating. And when the insect dives, the water pressure pushes the hair together so that it seals it up from the water pressure. It's incredible.
Those are larval forms, I think.
Right.
I know a mosquito has
mosquitoes,
that. And
right.
one way they used to get rid of mosquitoes was put a thin film of oil on the water. So they couldn't breathe
through their snorkel, right?
But now we shouldn't talk about oil on the water since our disaster in the Gulf.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then also a lot of aquatic plants maintain their buoyancy by storing oxygen in air sacs, vacuoles, right? And a few insects, again, mosquito larvae is one example, insert their breathing tubes into the air stores of the plants and get their oxygen that way without ever swimming to the surface of the water.
That's pretty clever.
So
there's coevolution.
That's right. That's right.
Right.
And then other aquatic insects, how are we on time? Other aquatic insects carry a bubble of air with them when they dive beneath the surface, and the bubble can be held under the wing or just trapped against body hairs.
I've seen that in insects.
Right.
Where they capture a bubble and just dive down with it.
That's right.
Yeah.
It provides sort of a short-term supply, but one of the functions of the bubble is that it will collect some oxygen molecules that are dissolved in the surrounding water. So the bubble actually acts as a physical gill, replenishing its supply of oxygen through diffusion up to a certain point. The larger the surface area of the bubble, the more efficiently the system works. So you can imagine the animal is breathing out the air from inside the bubble. The bubble is taking in air, diffusing it in from the water. But ultimately, the bubble will get smaller, and then the animal has to come to the surface to get some more air and fill up the store again.
Yeah. By the way, when we talk about insects and call them animals, remember they are animals. So
right.
it's not not that we're misusing the term. Of course, all living critters that are not plants, we can call animals.
This is true.
From the tiniest, even down to the plankton level, we call them animal plankton, zooplankton, these microscopic little critters.
That's right. Well, they're all under the umbrella of animalia.
Animalia, right.
The category in the taxonomy.
We have Linnaeus to thank for that.
That's for sure.
And he was quite a character. Now, he was a Swedish guy who set up this binomial system of names, you know, all the Latin names that we use.
Right, the generic name,
right.
the name of the genus and then the species.
Yeah,
right.
Because this is the way we can all agree on the name.
Right.
Because, you know, there are a lot of local names for different things. So insects are a huge, huge topic to talk about, but I'm glad Carol mentioned it today because she did that book on bees, so, and butterflies.
Right.
So that's a, you know, familiar insects to us.
Right.
And there are, I don't know, I think the insects are more numerous than anything else on Earth, except maybe bacteria.
I think that's right.
Yeah, the biggest category.
And we're also going to talk about mimicry, which is a big subject in the insect world.
Yeah,
because they're very vulnerable to predators, and they have many ways of disguising themselves, and they change. We talk about mimicry and how an animal will evolve to model itself after another animal that looks similar but has more protection, so that they can be defended and take advantage of the other animal's protection, the other animal's poison or
right. So we'll get into that on the next segment.
Okay.
Do you want to do that?
That's good.
Because I think this segment is almost over.
Very good.
So I'd like to remind folks that this is Heritage Radio Network and the program The Naturalist. And my guest today is Carol Butler. And our sponsor is Fairway Markets. And we'll be right back after this break. Hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the air with The Naturalist and my guest today, Carol Butler, famous author of books and my co-explainer at the Museum of Natural History, which I'm going to talk a little bit about today because it's getting to be summertime and kids' vacation time, and the museum is a great resource. If you scratch your head on a rainy day and you don't know what to do with your kids, if they're driving you crazy, well, the museum has terrific programs that are on all the time. So I'll talk a little bit about that first, and then Carol's going to come back and talk. You want to do the bats first, Carol, and
no,
then
let's,
the museum?
Let's talk
okay,
about
we'll
museum.
Do the museum. Okay, so if you want any information about the Museum of Natural History, go to their site, which is American Museum Natural History. You can just abbreviate it, AMNH, or www.amnh.org, /programs/. Okay? Because they have a huge website with all kinds of stuff on it. And that'll bring you to the calendar, which will tell you what's going on. But I'll just tell you about a few things today.
Let me just say, yes, our butterflies, we just ended the season of butterflies. And we even have a live video feed on the website in the Butterfly Conservatory, so that during the 8 months that we're open, you can go to the website and look in and see the butterflies flying around live in the conservatory. It's amazing.
But that's probably off in the summer now.
Yeah, no, it's just in the 8 months. It'll open again in October. But that's also, I'm just talking about it because it's on the website.
Good. Okay, so starting tonight at the museum, there's a field trip to the moon. It says, take a trip to the moon in this special members-only evening show in the Hayden Planetarium. So if you are a member of the museum, you could attend this special show tonight. We have this terrific planetarium with shows on all the time. And all of this would be on the museum's website. And we have this exhibit now called The Race to the End of the World. And it's about Antarctica. And it's a terrific exhibit that I'm going to be working in this summer, because I was in the Antarctica, and I'm really interested in that. So this one of the first lectures is, it's called Adventures in the Global Kitchen, and it's called Polar Cocktails.
Wow.
Now you may say, why are we talking about polar cocktails? Well, they're going to have a cocktail specialist, and he's going to talk about and mix up, and I'm sure you could taste them, cocktails inspired by Antarctica, by the Antarctic explorers. That'll be Tuesday night on the 8th. That's open to everybody. There's just a small admission fee, and you might think it might be a nice thing to do. And one interesting thing about this talk about cocktails in Antarctica is that recently they found a whiskey that was in the ice that was left by Shackleton, who was an early explorer in Antarctica.
Who was there when? In the 1800s or something?
He was there before even the South Pole was reached. It was his idea to form an expedition to go across Antarctica from one side to the other. And if you know anything about Shackleton, he failed at that. And it's a great story about Shackleton, which I won't go into now. But our exhibit at the museum deals with Scott and Amundsen, or Amundsen, however he says his name.
Well, so I'm curious, what's the story about Shackleton?
Oh, about the whiskey. He left this case of whiskey there when they left Antarctica, and it was recently discovered. So they're going to try it out and see if it's any good.
You think that's why his expedition failed?
Because he ran out of whiskey.
Okay.
He was English also, so English, I think, are great for cocktails. Okay, and then there's another one called, this is on every month, Friday night. It's called One Step Beyond. This monthly party series features the biggest names in techno, electronica, indie rock, and hip-hop. It's held in the planetarium, and it's a great musical event. I went once, and it was really interesting. That's not my kind of music, but I went to listen to it. Okay, and then we have this great exhibit called Snakes and Lizards, which will be there all summer. It's live critters. And Sunday, June 13th. By the way, on Sundays and Saturdays, they have great programs for kids. And this is one of the great programs. It says, this family-friendly program, learn about the Everglades and the ecosystems found there, and see some live animals, including an alligator, a crocodile, and a Burmese python. So you can see there's going to be a curator there, which will talk about them, and the kids can probably even touch maybe the python. It's about a 15-foot-long python. So that's one of the exhibits that's going to be there all summer, and it's a great place to take your kids. So I'll talk about programs at the museum. I'll tell you about two more of them, and then next week's show I'll tell you about some more. Okay, because there's so much stuff going on there. The museum even runs field trips, and if you're a foodie and you want to take a field trip about food, they have one on Wednesday, June 16th. It's called Food and Fauna in Hyde Park. Take a scenic journey to Hyde Park, New York, to tour the world-renowned Culinary Institute of America. Dine at the St. Andrews Cafe, which was terrific. I did that once. And visit President Franklin D. Roosevelt's birthplace. Okay, and if any of you are fans of Eleanor Roosevelt, make sure you visit her cottage. She had built her own cottage where her friends came to visit her. Okay, and one more thing, I'll tell you that this, because you have to sign up for this in advance. A Night at the Museum sleepover. Remember the movie A Night at the Museum Well, they sort of hooked up the museum. We don't have some of those things, but we have a lot of other good things. It says, explore the museum after hours and camp out under the watchful eye of the blue whale in the Milstein Hall of Ocean Life. So if you know the Hall of Ocean Life at the museum, it's this big, beautiful hall that's carpeted and has a huge video screen at one end of it, and you're underneath the great blue whale. The great blue whale is the biggest animal that has ever lived on Earth, and it still is. It's bigger than any of the dinosaurs ever were. And the one we have in the museum is a female great blue whale, and I think the model is 96 feet long. So it's really spectacular.
And they have these sleepovers are for children,
right?
Adults don't get any ideas about doing it.
No.
And they also have them periodically during the year.
They do.
It's not a one-time event. So
right.
If you're interested, take a look and find out when the next ones are.
Right, that's a good point, Carol. Mm-hmm. The next one is on June 25th. That's the snake exhibit. You don't want to stay over with the snakes. You know, because I heard some of them snore terribly, so you wouldn't want to do that. the next night at the museum is Saturday, June 19th. But the whole summer listing of them would be on the museum's website, because it has all the programs on there, the ongoing, all the exhibits, and especially for kids and families. Okay, so that's enough about our favorite museum, American Museum of Natural History, and you all know where that is, 81st Street and Central Park West.
Right.
Okay, so Carol, what were we going to talk about now? An update on the bats.
Well, I like to keep people updated about the bats. This is from Bat Conservation International's bulletin, and as of May of this year, as of May, more than 1 million bats have been killed by white nose syndrome, mostly in the Northeast. Everybody probably knows that the affected bats often have a white fungus on their muzzles and on other parts of the body, and they generally have very low body fat, and they move to cold parts of the hibernacula, and they fly during the day. I remember when they were first...
What's the hibernacula?
Where they hibernate.
Oh, where they hibernate.
Right, the cave that they hibernate in. And I remember that when they were first found, they would be found in this wandering around upstate New York in the snow, hopping around in the snow, which is completely crazy behavior for bats.
Mm.
So everybody knew something was wrong. And that's what happens. They don't have enough body fat. They're desperate. And they come out in the winter trying to feed and exhibit all kinds of uncharacteristic behavior. So the bulletin is that white nose syndrome has now spread to 12 states and to 2 Canadian provinces. It was recently confirmed in Quebec and Ontario. And in Tennessee, which is in from the East Coast, and it was found recently in individual bats further west in Missouri, and I even pulled out a map so I could be sure where these places were. Tennessee is sort of maybe a third of the way in towards the West Coast. Missouri might be in the center, almost, not quite. And Oklahoma is 450 miles west of that.
Mm-hmm.
So this
it's really spreading.
Really quite far across the country.
Mm.
And the big concern is that, or one of the big concerns, there are many, that in May, the fungus was found on the cave myotis, which is the 8th species that it's been found on. And that bat often shares a cave with a migratory Mexican free-tail bat. That's the bat that was found in Oklahoma with the fungus on it. So most bats, I'll say this, I think that I'm correct, most bats don't migrate.
Mm-hmm.
Most bats hibernate when there isn't sufficient food. And then when the weather warms up and the flowers bloom and there's more nectar and more insects, they come out of the cave and they feed themselves. But the Mexican free-tails migrate, some of them migrate. And the concern is, when you have an animal that's migrating 1,000 miles or more and it's exposed to the fungus, it could really spread the fungus even further from coast to coast and maybe into Mexico, which so far we haven't seen it that far.
So what do you think is going to happen with the bats?
Well,
do you think they'll develop an immunity to it, like...
Well, I don't know.
Evolutionary thing?
There have been meetings of all kinds of distinguished scientists that met in closed meetings. When I was working on the book, they had them. We couldn't even go. We wanted to go and just observe to see what they were talking about because we were writing the book and we couldn't get in. But there's a lot of high-level work on it. In New Jersey, in the hibernating bat population, about 90% of them have been killed. In the hibernium mine in New Jersey, they normally have about 30,000 bats spending the winter. They did a recent count, and there were only 1,700 bats that were alive.
Wow,
so
that's
it's really huge.
Devastating, yeah.
There is a virus that has been identified that likes the cold. Geomyces destructans is the name of it, and it invades the skin of bats, but scientists still aren't sure how it acts and how to stop it. And what's absolutely fascinating is that they have found the fungus on European bats, but they seem to get along fine and it doesn't kill them. So far, at least as far as we know, you always wonder if somebody didn't look in the right place.
Right.
But so far, nobody has reported mass casualties or bats wandering around in the snow in European species. Although there were anecdotal reports of bats with this fungus in Europe. So that's another puzzling aspect of it. And it is perhaps, as Bernie said, that the European species may have evolved an immunity to this fungus, or it may be that the fungus is more virulent in the version that we have in the United States. It's really hard to know. And now they're beginning to survey hibernating bats this time of year to see what the signs are and how it looks. And of course, the challenge is to really get a grip on this and understand what's involved and figure out how to save the bats.
Yeah, I mean, and you may think, why should I care about these bats? But, you know, the critters that have been around a long time, and they're valuable to us, even though you may never want to go near a bat or they still make you nervous. They're major insect eaters, and they are pollinators.
Important
a lot
pollinators.
Of fruits and is it mainly fruits? I think mainly
cactus.
Fruit.
They're
cactus.
Big pollinators of cactus. Any kind of night blooming flowers tend to be pollinated by bats.
Yeah. So they are a valuable creature for agriculture and for us. And, you know, if there are no more bats around, I mean, what are they going to write some of these horror stories about vampire bats and all that stuff?
Well, that's so distorting. Everybody always asks about that. I have to say it since we have very little time. There were only three species of vampire bats. They're only found in South America. And two of them only feed on chickens.
Right,
and
cattle.
One feeds on cattle.
Right.
And they really don't bother people unless you went and slept outside with no covering next to a cow that they had been feeding on. Then maybe they would bite your toe.
Right.
But they're really not dangerous. And in fact, I visited the rehabilitation facility in Texas. I know we're out of time, and was petting fruit bats that were just adorable. They came over to us like cats, just like cats, curious, nosy. They liked being petted. So,
yeah, they would probably make good pets for your house.
Fruit bats, because they're big enough.
You don't have to worry about hurting them. You know, because they're so big.
Right,
and they have fur on them. Just, you know, they're mammals, so they have hair, just like us. And some of them are cute looking. Some of them really look, you know.
Some of them are ugly. We have pictures in the bat
teeth sticking out and all that stuff.
Terrible,
But, you know, I see people with dogs who are pretty ugly little dogs.
It's certainly true.
So, you wouldn't have to take your bat out for a walk. I mean, you know, on a leash, it would be kind of difficult. You'd make a big hit with the singles gang. But, you know, because I know a guy who used to carry a snake around with him. Mm-hmm. In Central Park, he used to walk with his snake around his neck and all that. And he always got a lot of attention. All that. And once I even saw a guy with a rabbit on a leash in Riverside Park.
Wow.
And that was very unusual. But, you know, a lot of people came over and said, tell me about your rabbit and all that. And the rabbit's name was Harvey.
Oh, my.
You remember that story about Harvey
the
rabbit?
Yes, of course, the invisible rabbit.
The invisible rabbit, yes.
Yeah.
That was in a famous play, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yes, Harvey the rabbit. Okay, so we're going to wrap this session up. And I want to say again, thanks to Carol Butler for being with me today.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed
it. And we always have a good time together. And it's my chance to make some puns, which Carol seems to like. So that's good. And our sponsor today was Fairway Market. And remember, tune into Chef Erica's program. That's my daughter, whose program is terrific. It's probably better than mine. And her program is called Why We Cook. And one of these days I'll tell you a story about when my kids were small and I took them to a restaurant about eating soft shell crabs.
Oh, let's tell that on the next program.
Yeah, you want to hear that,
yes,
Carol?
Yes, okay. I'm curious to hear the story.
Okay, so we're going to sign off for today, and remember Heritage Radio Network, and we'll see you next time.